and welcome to the AIPT podcast, the podcast for people with poor taste. My name is Jason, and I will be your host today. Joining me is my co-host, Dave Hildebrand. Say hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
And we have a very special guest today. He is AdventureInPoorTaste.com's media and content manager. You know him, you love him. It is David Brook. Say hi, Dave.
Hey, guys.
So, how are you guys doing this evening?
Not too bad. Trying to unwind from a long and busy week so far. I've started my 31 days marathon of Halloween movies, and I've yet to pick out my number 4 movie for the night, so that will keep me busy after the podcast.
Do you mean number 4, as in you've already watched 3 tonight and you're about to cross off number 4?
No, I've watched one a day. So my first one on the first, I watched Call to Chucky. The second one, my second day, I fell asleep on It Follows. I will not go back and finish that monstrosity.
I love that movie.
Really?
The soundtrack of that movie is fantastic.
Oh, that movie scared the shit out of me, man.
You're joking me right now, right?
I know, man.
Did they ever really kind of come... I know we're getting a little off topic here, but did they ever come to verify whether or not a condom was enough to prevent you from getting the demon following you? Did it matter if you're having safe sex? I'm sorry, Dave. What was your day three?
My day three was a nice cheesy movie called Terror Vision, which actually I'll be writing a piece for on the site. I think it comes out this week.
Yeah, fans. So, yeah. If you are unfamiliar, us folks here at AdventuresInPoorTaste.com are in the midst of our Halloween celebration dubbed 31 Days of Halloween. As we get closer to the splendid day that everybody loves, Halloween, October 31st, we'll be reviewing, recommending, and discussing various pieces of underappreciated scary media, be it a book, comic, video game, event, a theme park, if you will, just kind of keep you guys up to date with the best parts of the season. I'd say probably one of my favorites. I've also been doing a day-to-day movie marathon, although I've done more than one per day, so I'm not on 4. I'm on like 5 or 6 at this point. But the thing I've been rewatching this Halloween season that's getting me back into my festive joy is the old Treehouse of Horror specials from The Simpsons. Each one is a classic, although they do kind of taper off after season 8. But, you know, those first 5 especially are fantastic, from the one where they do the Shinnin, Homer as Jack Torrance in The Shining is an amazing episode, but my all-time favorite is almost certainly, Nightmare on Evergreen Terrace, where Groundskeeper Willie is Freddy Krueger. David, how about you? What are you doing for your, what's your Halloween taste du jour?
Well, I have to say, I recently went to Halloween Horror Nights in Universal Studios, which has something like, I think, 9 haunted houses, although they're more like haunted warehouses, as they're so huge, and it takes quite a long time to get through them. But it's the best way, I think, for maybe, I think it's only like $50 to get in, to get horror of all ilks, so you can get clowns, zombies, gore, jump out scares, and they have these horror like zones, so when you walk between the warehouses or the haunted houses, you can get scared there too, and you can drink on the park, which is a bonus, which probably makes things a little less scary, but it does make things interesting. And this is in Florida, by the way.
Oh yeah, it's Orlando. I'm very well aware. I'm familiar with Halloween Horror Nights. I'm a Florida boy.
So well, I got that. They have that Harry Potter area, Diagon Alley there, and that's open at night. And I have to say, like, it's already a great section of the park during the day, but at night it's even crazier because of the detail. It's like you're really in a different place and like a different time.
You can get a couple butter beers in you, and you start a fight with some muggles, and yeah, you can relive the entire Harry Potter lifestyle.
Right, you drink there, and then you leave, and then you're beating up clowns. There was actually, let me just say one really quick thing, there was a clown who was really handicapped. He had no legs. He was in a wheelchair with a chainsaw that actually gave noise and smoke out, and he would chase people. And honestly, I've never seen women scream and run as fast as they did when that guy was after them.
Now, I have to admit that that's a terrifying image, but I'm a little less scared of something that I can get away from through going up one stair.
That's in poor taste because you're offending zombie clowns with no legs.
While I apologize to the evil mutilated crown branch that might be listening to us, I also have to say this is Adventures in Poor Taste. I'm not going to defend the fact that I have crappy taste. That's for our guests, and that's coming up later.
Thanks for the reminder, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, moving on from Halloween, we'll take a second to take a look at what's in the comic news, and pretty much all news has been sort of dominated by the tragic events of Monday. And while we won't touch on anything political or any kind of gun rights really message, it has touched the world of comics in that the Punisher, which is set to have a premiere on Netflix later this year. And was all set to have a pretty big presence at New York City Comic Con this weekend. It recently announced that it will no longer be appearing at New York City Comic Con. Looking at their message specifically, and not reading it in a funny accent as I did before, because this is a serious time. The people from the show said that we are stunned and saddened by this week's senseless acts. And after careful consideration, Netflix and Marvel have decided it wouldn't be appropriate for Marvel's The Punisher to participate in New York Comic Con this week. I guess opening question to you guys based off of this news. How do you react knowing that this was, for a lot of people, a pretty big reason that they were going to New York Comic Con? Obviously, you can't predict tragedies like this. How do you feel about this news coming out?
I get it. But at the same time, I don't know, I'm kind of surprised by it, because the Punisher, everyone's been looking forward to, everybody wants to see more of it, but I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but at the same time, I start thinking of, like, people that dress up for cosplay and everything. Are they going to, you know, not dress up as that, or do they think they're going to look at, you know, a second glance now, why are you dressed like that? They've pulled this, you know. I'm curious to see if that reaction is going to carry and how long, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's actually something that I hadn't considered. So many people's cosplay, whether they're the Punisher or not, does involve, you know, a fake firearm being brought in. I know that a lot of these facilities are, you know, they train their door staff to be pretty strict with all of the weapons to make sure that they're fake. But I can imagine it being a little bit more restrictive given recent events.
I think it's unfortunate that they're not going to be having a panel on this, especially since when I was in San Diego Comic-Con, there was a Defenders panel, but they ended up having the actor who plays Punisher, I forget his name now.
Jon Bernthal.
He came out, and they showed a six-minute clip, and it was amazing, and the audience loved it. And I'm sure it would have been a huge success if they had this panel at New York Comic Con. It makes sense if whatever they were going to show in the footage would be insensitive based on what just happened. So, I mean, but that's just me guessing. Maybe it's just they're pulling it because there's violence in it in general. but I wonder if New York Comic Con was 4 weeks from now, if they still would have pulled it, or if it was because it's so close to Monday.
I mean, yeah, my assumption is that they're undoubtedly it's them playing safe. They don't want to risk offending people or turning someone off from a property that has had a lot of positive press going into it and has generated a lot of excitement by being so close to a national tragedy that is actually affecting people's, like, minds and bits.
You bring up a good point. Like, they probably already have all the buzz they need, so pulling it doesn't hurt their ability to get viewers to watch it.
Sure, but it will probably remove, like, so much news comes out of these events.
True.
Just like the news that's going to be appearing on AdventuresInPoorTaste.com all week. Plug. But so much of that works as word of mouth and generating excitement. So it is a lost opportunity, but I don't know that it's going to hurt them too much. I don't think that people genuinely, I don't think that Marvel shows tend to move the needle on Netflix subscriptions per se. I think that it's a good, you know, incentive, but it's one of those things like, I might like Solitaire, but I'm not buying a computer to play Solitaire. I don't know, that was a faulty analogy. But moving from one tragedy to a much less serious tragedy, Iron Fist, the TV show from Marvel's Netflix variety that did not quite do so well. I myself attempted to review episode by episode and kind of couldn't get past episode 5. I've since watched all the episodes, and I can say it's still god awful, and it's not a good movie. Or a TV series, I guess, is the appropriate terminology.
I was worried that show killed you, because you were telling us you were going to review every episode, and then all of a sudden it just stopped coming in.
I felt like I was going to Lil Engine it could it, I think I can, and geez, yeah. You know what, it broke me. But
I've yet to attempt watching it yet, just because of all the negative feedback I think I've heard from every single person that I know.
Did you watch The Defenders?
I did not, because to be honest, I still have to get through Luke Cage. I was told that I could watch Defenders, it wouldn't really affect anything, but I'm that type where I want to watch everything leading up to it. So I might even suffer through Iron Fist before I do Defenders, but
I would say Luke Cage, absolutely worth it. The second half, not as strong as the first half, but that first half is great. And you can probably skip Iron Fist. It really doesn't add anything to Defenders.
Okay.
Just like Danny Rand does little to add to it. But speaking of things Danny Rand is being added to, segue again, there has been, 2 hours ago, it was reported by CBR.com that Danny Rand, a.k.a. Iron Fist, will be returning to the Marvel Netflix Cinematic Universe in the forthcoming season of Luke Cage Season 2, as there are now pictures of the two appearing from Entertainment Weekly, it looks like. I guess, Dave, it's going to be a little hard for you to weigh in on this, having not seen any of the media that involves him, but David, what do you think about the return of Danny Rand to the small screen?
I think it's great. I think Power Man and
Iron Fist.
I was wondering if he had a different name. I wonder if I think that is an incredible duo in the comic scene, and it has been over the years. Although it's, I don't know if it's ever reached its potential. So seeing it in the TV form could be a huge bonus for fans who have liked the characters in the comics but want to see a little bit more. And going back to what you said about Defenders, I think that started to establish the relationship, and I think the actors can work really well together. They haven't had a ton of opportunities, so I'm excited to see where they take it in the show.
Did you watch Iron Fist? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask David, did you watch Iron Fist?
I watched Iron Fist all the way through, and I didn't finish Cage, though, funny enough. I didn't watch the last, like, one or two. But, I did watch Iron Fist, and I kind of agree with Jason. It was pretty much unwatchable at times. I still found a silver lining in it here and there. The very end, kind of, again, it was just like rushing to get things over with.
I mean, the only likable character to come out of it was Colleen Wing, and the Meachums were literally the worst written group on any television show that I watched. But as we discussed beforehand, I don't watch The Big Bang Theory. And it was not well paced, not well plotted.
No.
Iron Fist is a pretty metaphysical character with a lot of mystical elements to him, and they don't really touch on that in any kind of satisfactory way.
They did a lot of explaining off camera, like he would say things happen, like, and you'd be like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, and I know that he's been in this weird temple since he was like 12 years old, but I think that he would have some social sense to know that walking up to saying to someone, I am the Iron Fist, 95% of the time is not going to get the response that you're looking for. Like, it's just not, I don't know.
With Defenders, you can see he's starting to act like the billionaire that he should be, and that he's got a chip on his shoulder, and him and Luke Cage are starting to establish an interesting relationship, so that could definitely go in an interesting way.
Sure, there was that episode where, spoiler alert, although it's not really much of a spoiler, where they have to restrain Danny, and he's tied to a chair, but like Luke is there watching over him, and they kind of start to establish a rapport. I would have liked to see more of those, because I'm a fan of the old Luke Cage Iron Fist comics. I have several of the trades, or the compendiums of those books, and it's just fun 70s pulp. A little cringeworthy sometimes, because it was written in the 70s, and Marvel was a lot more loose-lipped with its, I'll call them socially awkward comments back then.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still... It's still fun series. I don't know. I look forward to seeing him in the second Caesar Cage.
I recently reviewed Power Man and Iron Fist Volume 3, and it was quite good. It was really good at capturing the street level of the people, and there's actually a street magic character that was fascinating. Who was like the sorcerer supreme of the street. Anyway, that's neither here nor there, but it was very entertaining.
Well, moving along from the small screen to the big screen, and tying in with our episode's big central theme, it appears that Hannah Beachler, one of the key production designers for the upcoming Black Panther movie, which looks awesome, by the way, I'm really looking forward to that movie, says that a lot of the cinematic approach they've taken toward the design of Wakanda, the home country of the Black Panther, of course, was taken from Blade Runner's original concept art of the new version of Los Angeles. Do you guys think that it makes sense to draw from hyper sci-fi into this superhero production?
I think so. A lot of Blade Runner was inspired by the an Egyptian style hotel that's in LA, right? Am I wrong about that?
Are you talking about the Luxor? That's in
That's in Vegas.
It's Las Vegas. Oh, I thought it was in LA. Never mind. But anyway, there's like an Egyptian thing going on, which is an ancient, right? An ancient but modern look, which would make sense for Wakanda since it's very old but also very advanced technologically. Sure.
Also in Africa, makes sense to have that little connection, I suppose. Although, I guess the question that I have there is that Wakanda is, historically speaking, as if it were a real place, is very, like, exclusionary. Like, it's just them. They don't touch the outside world unless they have to. They maintain their borders. They don't trade externally. It doesn't seem like a lot of external influence would come into them. Now, if it is ancient Egypt, who's to say? I don't know the history of Wakanda that well. Like, they could have not been their own unique country at the time when the Egyptian Empire was a thing. But for more modern takes, it seems like they would be developing their own scientific approach towards things.
Right.
Dave, how do you feel?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Black Panther also. The trailer surprised me. But yeah, I see where they're pulling from it, and it'll be interesting to see how that comes through on the big screen.
Well, that is a good, great, and fantastic all at once segue right into our key topic of this evening, Blade Runner. Blade Runner 2049 will be out this Friday, starring Ryan Gosling, Harrison Ford, and of course everyone's favorite Joker, Jack Nicholson. No, Jack Nicholson's not in it, it's Jared Leto. Well, he's my favorite Joker. I don't
know. You just got excited, man.
animatronic Jack Nicholson could not be reached for comment. But with this new and expanded lore of the series coming to the forefront, I guess we feel like now is a great time to reflect on both the legacy, is that word, Marvel, and the cultural impact of the Blade Runner series. So, guys, I guess all these years later, 25 years into the future here, how do we feel about the movie Blade Runner?
Well, I think what all three of us, between the past 2 weeks, we all revisited the film. And it's been quite a few years since I saw it. So it's funny because my first thought was, damn, The Fifth Element ripped off a hell of a lot from this movie. So, and what's that?
Interesting. I never would have thought that.
Well, that was my first impression.
Basic opinion, except mine was mostly like, "Wow, this looks an awful lot like Akira."
Oh yeah, that's a good point too. Well, which ones did you all rewatch? I rewatched I rewatched the cut where it just fades to black after the elevator door closes. I believe that's considered the final cut.
I watched the theatrical cut that had the terrible voiceover from Harrison Ford.
I think we watched the same one, David, because I just watched it last night, and it ended that way, yes.
Right, and then the theatrical cut, it shows them, like, escaping off to wherever they go.
They get into a car, and the terrible, terrible voiceover. Seriously, Harrison Ford could not be giving a single fuck when he was reading these lines. said that not only were they escaping together into, like, it ends with these weird, like, out of nowhere shots of, like, the valleys and mountains of California. Like, LA is this diseased hellhole with constant trash and rain and, like, giant fireballs that shoot into the sky everywhere, and yet, like, a couple blocks out, it's a fucking gorgeous country again.
Oh, I actually have a fun fact about that. I don't know if you know this, but, you know, the movie The Shining by Stanley Kubrick? Well, he filmed, like, hundreds of hours of a helicopter flying through the mountains to get a good panning shot of the hotel. And I guess Stanley Kubrick was stuck and didn't know how to end the movie. And I'm sorry, Ridley Scott was stuck and didn't know how to end Blade Runner. And I guess Stanley Kubrick gave him footage. And that's the footage. It's from actually shooting The Shining.
You know, I definitely got that impression. It's a very similar tracking shot to a lot of the more, like, I guess, establishing shots from The Shining. So that makes a ton of sense.
So now I have to go back and watch a theatrical cut to see that, because that's interesting. I now want to see that.
I mean, again, I didn't even finish, because it's not just that they are driving out into this pristine countryside that still exists, but they are in the voiceover. Harrison Ford says that before he died, Tyrell told me that Rachel doesn't have an expiration date, so we're going to go out and live our lives not knowing what comes next. It was the most, like, oh my god.
It puts that happy Hollywood ending bow on it.
Yeah, and, like, you know, the thing is, when you watch the non-theatrical cut that doesn't have the voiceover, it is definitely better. There's not, like, an argument to be had there. But you notice that because it's all shot in noir style, they may have always intended for there to be a voiceover, and just Harrison Ford just, again, delivered a really shitty read, and they just took it out when Ridley Scott saw the dailies. But there's so much dead space between words, and all of these shots of them just, like, going somewhere with him looking pensive into the wall or, you know, staring off into space, that in the theatrical cut, there is narration, so it makes sense that they have these shots. But when you take the narration out, it really is just lots of people staring into the darkness.
Right. That makes sense. They did mention in the movie at some point, didn't the replicant that he runs off with, didn't she mention that up in the north it's, like, free and there's no pollution or something? Didn't she say that in one of the scenes?
I thought I remembered her saying that there was no, like, persecution. Like, people weren't trying to kill the replicants up there.
Right.
Right.
Like, this is just an LA thing, you guys. Everywhere else is cool with the robots.
Yeah, I'm glad they excised that.
So with this new film, I know we lightly touched on it. Harrison Ford is in it. And from what I understand, he's in it. I mean, you know, it's not like a 5-minute cameo or whatever, they move on. So what role do you all think he's going to play in it? Do you think he's a replicant?
I know that Ridley Scott has since come out and said without question that Harrison Ford's a replicant. So I guess in a certain degree of headcanon, everybody's already made up their mind. It's been one of those R plus L equals J style theories that pretty much everyone has adopted. But I feel like the fact that he looks every inch of his 74-year-old ass suggests that he's not a replicant. The replicants don't seem to age, and admittedly it's because most of them have a 4-year lifespan, but by what logic would their skin start to sag and their hair turn gray if it's all artificial? Like, if nothing else, they could certainly go and get repair parts and get touch-ups. That was the entire reason that Roy sought out Tyrell in the first place, or J.F. Sebastian. Like, they needed to get upgrades. So, completely an option, and Deckard didn't take it. I think that he's just an old-ass man.
I'm wondering if they made the replicants really, really good, and they were supposed to age so that they could fool anyone, even over decades, and maybe that would be an explanation for why he's a replicant. I'm with you, though. I kind of hope he's a human. I know Harrison Ford came out and said that he thinks he's human, but if Ridley Scott is producing his movie, which I think he is, he probably has a say as far as whether or not we find out. Now, that's actually something I was talking about with one of my friends earlier today. If Hollywood and the producers of this movie are smart, they won't tell us if he's a replicant or not. Because why let loose that magic? Why let loose the fact that the answer to that question? why not have people continue to debate and question each other and feel right with their answer? Why ruin that?
Sure, you got to build that Blade Runner cinematic universe that we've all been asking for so many years.
Or what? Well, the big question is, will Sean Young climb out of career hell and come back? How are they going to explain what happens to her?
I mean, she was unquestionably a replicant, so I feel like...
But if she has no expiration date, where is she in the new one?
That's questioning if the shitty narration was technically canon, or if that was just some crap that everybody was like, no, this was dumb, let's not do that.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if she's just like a husk that's like in the corner that he pulls out like a fleshlight, and sorry, I went there.
I'll say
that's what's been keeping him alive all these years.
It doesn't mean that she's not in the movie, but she is not listed among the stars of this film.
They've
got to reference her. Why wouldn't they?
Oh no, they have to reference her. But whether or not she actually physically appears, right, be it in flashback or as like a like not a husk, but like you see her, you know, that's the shell over there. One day I'm going to power her up again. That sort of thing.
So one reason why I don't think this will come up is Harrison Ford has come out and said this movie could stand alone. It doesn't have to. It's not. You don't have to see the first one to really understand it. And going into that kind of detail about the last one and this one, it just makes it so it is more reliant on the first film. So why not just not reference her at all?
You have to reference her.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a throwaway line. She doesn't have to be a central plot point or anything, and I would rather that she's not. I think that it's good that their focus with this movie was creating a standalone piece of art versus, you know, again, that cinematic universe thing that I joked about, because Lord knows I don't need more of those in my life.
Yeah.
Sean Young showed up in Ridley Scott's office dressed up in a Catwoman costume demanding she got put in Blade Runner.
I thought that she did that to Tim Burton's office trying to be in Batman.
She did. That's why I was being funny about it.
Ah, gotcha. Oh, that southern sarcasm is so hard to catch.
He got you there. He got you.
I don't think she's been stable her whole career.
No, she tried to stab those people, right? Like, wasn't that her thing?
I think that she had, like, scissors or something.
Yeah, I thought it was like a bottle. Like, she crashed a bottle and like tried to stab someone with like the rest of her like wine bottle.
Okay, that's
because she was definitely a problem alcoholic, and it led to severely erratic behavior. But yeah,
so
I'm really excited for this movie. I'm actually going to see it tomorrow. Are you guys going to see it?
I'm going to catch it this weekend, I think.
Yeah, there's talk about me seeing it on Friday.
The theaters around here are doing a double feature where, you know, they're playing them both back-to-back, and I've never seen Blade Runner on the big screen, so I think that might be pretty cool to do.
Oh, that's fun. I had the chance to see Indiana Jones on the big screen once, and it was amazing.
Oh, sure. I saw Friday the 13th Part 2 in the theaters on the big screen. It was one of my favorite cinema-going experiences of all time.
I'm particularly excited about Blade Runner 2049 because I'm seeing it on the IMAX screen, which I haven't been to since Dark Knight Returns.
Are you doing the 3D IMAX?
No, God no. God no. I hate 3D with a passion. I saw Avatar in 3D because this was the second time I saw it because everyone said you had to, and it was just terrible. I hated it.
Well, that's because Avatar was terrible.
Yeah, not a very good movie.
It wasn't the 3D, sir. It just soured the 3D for you.
3D just flattens the background, and everything else is, like, popping out. But then it flattens it to the point where it doesn't actually... It looks more fake than if you just were to watch it in 2D.
I feel that way about certain high-definition televisions that aren't, like, properly adjusted. Like, it looks like everything you're watching is a soap opera.
Interesting, yeah.
The Force Awakens in 3D was pretty decent.
But anyway, back to Blade Runner. one of the elements of it, speaking of, you know, going back to the comments from the production designer for Black Panther, is just the undeniable impact it's had on cinema that is set in the future. Blade Runner, the original, set in 2019, so in the next 2 years, we've got you can expect a lot of bad things to happen to LA. It's going to be a total hellhole. Lots of robots running around, lots of paper flying everywhere. But we're going to get flying cars out of it, evidently, so that's going to be neat. But as we were discussing at the onset, rewatching it now, especially because, like Dave, it's been a while since I had seen it, so many movies, TV series, comics, video games, so much cinema and just art in general borrows from the aesthetic of Blade Runner. And it's undeniably, you know, Blade Runner-esque. You can't see, as we mentioned earlier, like Ghost in the Shell without thinking of Blade Runner. You can't see something like Final Fantasy VII without thinking of Blade Runner.
Right.
I guess what do we think that this is what the future is going to look like? Is it going to be gross dystopic Neo-LA?
I don't know. I mean, even the angular vehicles, they're like impossibly shaped. They're not made for aerodynamic travel, which is probably why it's such a striking universe and design aesthetic. Which, by the way, was all designed by an artist named Sid Mead. I actually just recently reviewed his art book, and it goes through his career, and it's kind of fascinating where he influenced films and actually designed a lot of them. But anyway, will the future be like this?
Yeah, do we think that there's going to be giant dark towers with holes all over the roof leading to incredibly wet floors everywhere you go, almost no light, constant searchlights going through your house, giant flaming balls getting shot through the sky from the top of every tower?
If Trump gets elected a second term, yes.
I mean,
I was discussing this last night with my friend that we were watching the movie. Like, I want to just see a scene where there's some bean counter at one of these companies. Like, sir, the amount of money we're spending on fuel to shoot fireballs into the sky is just bankrupting us. We need to do something about this.
It's very despotic. I mean, it's nihilistic even. I mean, that's why it's film noir, right? Blade Runner?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And technically, neo-noir.
Yes,
neo-noir. I actually took a film noir class in college, and we had to watch this film as part of the syllabus. And the teacher wasn't wrong, that's for sure. I mean, visually even, it's up there with just like, wow, the future sucks, and it's not going to be great. I mean, here's one thing that they probably nailed, the population density. I mean, at the rate we're going, we're going to eventually have, maybe not everywhere, but in cities, it's going to be like that. I mean, it already is sort of like that, where there's people everywhere. And a lot of the iconography in that film is, I don't know if it's Chinese or Japanese, but
it's a little of both, yeah. Actually. There's several Chinese elements to it, Japanese elements to it, and Korean elements as well.
Right. So I assume maybe there was an invasion of China to America or something. Why would there be so many?
Well, it's Los Angeles. Los Angeles has the largest Chinese-American population. So, I mean, it would make a ton of sense that if there is a city that's going to have a large Asian influence, that China would be, or China. Yes, obviously China would be a pretty big Asian influence, but Los Angeles seems like a pretty good home for it. Them and San Francisco have enormous Asian populations, so.
A large part of that movie, they reference off-planet affairs, like people mining on other planets and flying around space.
That's actually where the Nexus 6 robots are from. They were all working off planet, and to touch on the plot, I guess, a little bit. Roy Batty and the rest of his replicant buddies were droids, I guess you'd call them, that worked for the military, most of them being battle droids, but some of them being pleasure bots, which does not sound all that pleasant if you were a cognizant robot. But they were so tired of their lives and wanted to live with their own sense of freedom that they killed a bunch of people and escaped. One of the replicants died on their route to Earth, but the five that made it to Earth are the ones that we see him track down. There's some implication that Rachel may have been one of these Nexus 6 models, but Tyrell says that she's newer when he first introduces her and that he's been, like, tinkering with her, so I don't think that she technically qualifies. I think that's just the Detective Brian who brings Deckard back into the fold being racist against robots.
Right.
So did it hold up compared to when you guys first saw it?
I was surprised how simple it was. The plot is just so basic. I mean, there's not a lot to it, and it, my memories seem to suggest that it was this robust, amazing story. When really, it's the backgrounds, it's the cinematography that's amazing and robust and complex. And the story is just so simple. Like, it's not bad, but it's also not like, wow, this was a masterpiece. At least that's how I felt.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say that it is a visual piece of art. It is something that you take in with your eyes more than with anything else. Because, I mean, that's cinema in general, but, like, the story, I remember when I watched it when I was, like, 14, 15, and not really understanding what was going on. I think I was kind of lost a lot. But I was also watching the version that didn't have the overly expository narration that totally told me everything I was supposed to know about every scene. But watching it again, I found the plot to be a little bit simple, a little bit, you know, direct. But that's also, you can't deny that that's also because there's been so much work since Blade Runner that is, in one way or another, an homage to Blade Runner. Like, it copies a lot of elements to it and takes not just the visual style, which obviously is pretty ubiquitous in all media, but, like, the storylines, which are, yeah, it's simple. It's pretty basic noir, guys escape their unit and I gotta track them down sort of thing. But I think that as a film, it still holds up. I question a lot of Ridley Scott's timing of it. And I think that part of that has to do with Vangelis's score, which, perfect for the movie, really great, but it means that there have to be these long, swooping shots of people doing nothing. And yet, with the movie that clocks in at just under 2 hours, you start to wonder, why are we staring off into space for a solid 5 minutes at a time? Why is every character's dialogue delivered in staccato? Why is everything so slow? That's my complaint with the movie.
Right, and
can I just jump on that really quick? Just one thing. It's funny that you say it's slow, because the one scene that's not slow, I hate, where the girl is running through the glass. I think that was just so poorly done.
I mean, even that is slow, because when they actually shoot her, she runs through like six more panels of glass in slow motion. And,
it's like a bit in Simpsons or something.
Yeah, like if you sped that scene up and played like Yakety Sax over it, it would be just as serious.
Or maybe even Nickelback.
Well, no. Everything is serious with Nickelback, obviously.
My thoughts on it was the whole universe, and like you said, the score seemed to take, you know, front and center. I enjoyed it so much, but then it was like, you know, the story, like both of you said, was just so simplistic. And another thing, I didn't remember the fight between him and Daryl Hannah, and then it was like, once it started, it was like over with, and I was like, okay, well, there wasn't a whole lot more involved in that, you know. For a movie that's so visually, you know, powerful, I guess to put, the action scenes, I thought, were just so basic. There was nothing deep into them. There's no long, you know, battles, drawn-out fights, nothing that felt real suspenseful.
Even when that replicant gets shot in the head, it's like, all of a sudden, his head has a hole in it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, give the Alien series notwithstanding, Ridley Scott's not really much of an action director. Like, he doesn't do things, I think, that are terribly, like, exciting. And, I mean, the other portion of it is you can't really, as a human, engage one of these replicants in a hand-to-hand fisticuffs and think that you're going to get away with it, especially Deckard. Deckard's not a fighter. Deckard is, you know, a detective. So it all comes down to who gets the gun first. And when he is fighting Harry Bryant, the guy you're talking about with the mustache, he you know, knocks the gun out of his hand really quick, and then he gets the shit kicked out of him by him because he's got no fucking chance against this thing. It's a, you know, it is a giant literal murder machine. There's no getting away with it. And even when he fights Pris, Daryl Hannah, as you mentioned, like, she is so acrobatic and gets all over the place. It's literally a lucky shot that gets her, because she decided to use the power of cartwheels to fight for some reason.
You know, it's fascinating. I'm talking about this, I'm wondering about, like, Terminator and how you have this killer machine that, and they put so much focus on the machine being not only able to like take damage and not feel it, but also just inflict all this incredible violence on humans. Meanwhile, in Blade Runner, in the fight scenes, it's almost like they're trying to focus on these things, the replicants, being so human that that part of it, the fact that they can lift 300 tons without even sweating, is sort of forgotten.
Well, I mean, the whole slogan of the Tyrell company is more human than human.
Right.
Which, of course, sets off every Rob Zombie voice in my head whenever he says
oh,
that.
Oh, nice. That's a good one. I loved that song when I was growing up.
What's wrong with it now, man?
Rob Zombie's going to be in town tomorrow night. We'll go and listen to that song and wear in Blade Runner shirt.
That's if he plays the song, I suppose.
Oh, he always plays that in Thunderkiss.
I guess, yeah, because when I saw him... Anyway, that's off topic. I don't need to talk about my last White Zombie jaunt. Getting back into it, though, one thing that I feel is kind of the heart and soul of the movie, one of the reasons why, despite it being a relatively weakly written movie, why it's so favorably remembered, is that final soliloquy from Roy in the rain at the end of the movie. Excuse me. Where he delivers the line like, "I've seen things you wouldn't believe," you know, and talks about the battleships burning off the coast of Saturn or whatever it is, and then ends with like the beautifully poignant line, "All of these memories will be lost in time, like tears in rain," and it's a great bit of cinema, a great bit of acting. But what I find the most interesting about it is, it's obviously very well celebrated as a piece and usually cited whenever anybody questions the acting ability of Rutger Hauer. It's largely improvised. A lot of what he drops there was not in the script. That's almost 100% Hauer coming through there. How do you guys feel about the death scene of Roy Batty?
I was aware of this factoid when I was watching it last night, and the first thought I had was, if I had to act in 40 degree rain for 4 hours straight, I too would start randomly saying really poetic things that probably, for me it would be nonsensical and crazy, but it would still be random and possibly beautiful.
See, when I first heard that he came up with that most of himself, I was kind of amazed by it because, you know, I heard that well after the fact that I first watched it. And in between then, I saw such great movies as, you know, The Hitcher and The Hobo with the Shotgun. So to go back and see that he put that together and it's so well done, and it's a defining moment at the end of the film. You know, he knows it's the end of himself, and he's just laying it all out on the table. I think it was an impressive performance by him.
It was amazing words, too. I mean, it was perfect, because it was about, like, what is life, right?
Well, I mean, it's more about, I take it as the value of an individual life.
Right, right.
As an individual, you know, it's about your own personal memories being the sum totality of your being. It's what you are. It's who you are as a thing. As a sentient being with such a short lifespan, knowing that it's coming to the end, although it doesn't technically make a lot of sense because they say that he was built in 2016, but he has a 4-year lifespan, so he should be living through 2020, not dying randomly in 2019. But it's sort of like a beautiful musing about... I guess the finality and overall the banality of death, like all of these things that I've done that meant so much to me or that are such gripping visuals that like nobody talks about when no one has seen before and will never see again are just going to be gone once I'm gone. Like it's totally fits the, as you put it, nihilistic approach that the movie is very steeped in.
And it applies to robots and humans.
That's sort of the whole point. But right. robots and humans are basically the same, man. We all dream of electric sheep sometimes.
What? Another Philip K. Dick property.
Well, this was based off of Robot's Dream about purple electric sheep.
Yep.
Purple sheep.
Purple electric sheep.
Have you guys read that comic book? It's fantastic.
I have not.
I have not either. It's one of those ones that I like to pick up. Go ahead.
He has like a robot, but she's like a, he has a robot body, and I don't know, it's really weird.
Huh. So here's another question to see what you all think of. So since using CGI to create past characters is like the fad now, when you had it like with Rogue One, with Princess Leia and Grand Moff Tarkin, do you think we might see a CGI Rutger Hauer in the new one?
I would hope not. I kind of don't feel like... It seems to me that given that you had these six robots of the same generation, and none of them look alike, not a one looks like the other, like, why would they make another Roy Batty design? Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that there would be another Rutger Hauer. Unless they're, like, keeping him on top of that building like a gargoyle, like, I don't see why you would bring... back Rutger Hauer digitally or otherwise.
Yeah, I feel like that would tarnish the performance he did if they brought back this shell of a machine like the Logan Adamantium sculpture.
Yeah.
But it's Hollywood. I could see them doing it.
I mean, he could be dancing with a vacuum cleaner on TV. Like, they've done that before, but it doesn't mean that I think that they're going to. I think that this movie, from at least the marketing campaign and a lot of the buzz going around, it seems like it's maintaining as much integrity as it can about the property. And I think that that includes not bringing back, Rutger Hauer. The Sean Young thing, maybe. Maybe she makes a reappearance because, again, I feel like she could add something to the story. I don't think that she needs to be a focus at all, but a little nod to what happened to Rachel would be nice. But I don't think that any of the other characters from the original movie, with the possible exception of Edward James Olmos's gaff, if he's like the chief of police now, then maybe that's something. But even he, God, he's got to be like 90 years old. He's ancient, so it doesn't make a lot of sense for other characters to appear in it.
I don't mean to go along with your integrity comment. I mean, they've got Sid Mead designing some of the buildings in the new movie, too. So, I mean, they're trying to really, really capture the original, the magic of the first one. And that means not tarnishing it at the same time.
here's a tangential question off this that we kind of touched on a little bit. With the ubiquity of the aesthetic of Sid Mead, and Blade Runner in general, what's your favorite work of fiction that incorporates a heavy influence from Blade Runner? Like, I say that knowing that I don't have an immediate favorite that jumps to mind, because there's like seven or eight things that jump to mind. Like, I love Final Fantasy VII, and I guess to an extent Final Fantasy VI, although that's more steampunk than cyberpunk, but I don't know that I would value that over something like Akira, which I think is a better manga than it is a movie, but it's still like, you know, a very visual and surreal representation of, like, you know, my entry into nerddom in general.
I'm gonna go ahead and say what I said in the beginning, and that's The Fifth Element. I like The Fifth Element a lot, and like I said, when I got 15 minutes into Blade Runner, I was like, damn, The Fifth Element ripped off a lot of shit from this film. You know, I like Gary Oldman, I like Bruce Willis, and The Fifth Element is just a fun film all the way around. But it also has, like, you know, the buildings with the images on the sides, you have the flying cars, you have just that whole, you know, society and universe, and I think that, you know, they took it from Blade Runner. Am I wrong?
I don't know if you're right.
That's why I said, am I wrong?
Well, the film that just came out, the Thousand Planets, what is that called? Valerian.
Yeah, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I think that Luc Besson has said that sort of inspired Fifth Element, and that he grew up with that comic book, the Valerian comic book, and I wonder if that inspired it more, but you might not be wrong. I mean, obviously Blade Runner probably influenced him as well, especially the towering cities and scapes, but it also isn't a dark, nihilistic kind of world. It's very bright and...
Well, that's what I said. It's more of a light-hearted. Yeah. But, you know.
You could be right.
I mean, I think it could be both. Valerian, as a comic series, predates even Star Wars. So, I mean, its impact on science fiction is immeasurable. Like, you know, George Lucas has said very much so that he gathered bits from Valerian, which itself gathered bits from, you know, Arabian Nights, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, I think, is the specific story. There's so much borrowing from it. Not to keep pigeonholing myself as the anime guy, but I think that now I'm probably ready to say that my favorite bit of Blade Runner homage or pastiche is probably Cowboy Bebop. It's just a brilliant show. It definitely keeps with the sort of noir detective vibe, and instead of Vangelis's like, you know, sweeping orchestral movements, it incorporates like jazz and bebop jazz and like just free jazz, and it just adds so much to the dynamic. So it becomes very much like, I honor my source material, but I'm gonna, you know, change it up a little bit.
I think my choice might be Gattaca. I don't know if Gattaca would really fit as inspired by Blade Runner, but it definitely has a negative look at the future and how there are these perfect beings, these people. In this case, they're not robots, but they're
these people, genetically designed people. Yeah,
right, exactly. And then the visuals of that film are striking. Not in the same way again, but again, it's California, and the main character is trying to navigate this world that he's not really a part of, which I think they were kind of doing with Decker, maybe not. I don't know. But Gattaca is one of my favorite films of all time, so I'm just going to throw Gattaca in the pile there.
I had no idea you were such an Ethan Hawke fan.
I love Ethan Hawke, man. He's so good.
I've never seen Gattaca.
Oh, man, you got to see it. It's one of the best science fiction films ever, I think.
I was going to say, if you add the I think, I'll accept it, but I don't know that I'm ready to call that in one of the best science fiction movies ever.
Oh, and literally just this week, I think, or maybe it was last week, scientists revealed that they can expunge any diseases out of embryos. We're going down this road where Gattaca will be the future. And because, Dave, since you haven't seen it, it's this future where when you go to the doctor to have a baby with your wife, you can literally like choose everything, their eyes, their hair, everything, and they will be efficient, perfect. There will be no disease, they'll be super smart, and they'll be incredibly healthy. And only these people get the best jobs. But you have to have money in order to do it. And I think the main character's parents weren't rich or anything, so he ended up having a heart defect. But he wants to be this astronomer, and he pushes himself to get that, what he wants. Jude Law's in it, too. He's great in it, I think.
Of course he plays a perfect human being, because Jude Law is a beautiful human being.
He does.
There's just, yeah, I mean, whatever. And the Gattaca is the corresponding letters for the alleles that make the perfect genetic code, something like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's actually fascinating.
Well, in the movie, I think. I don't think that they have an idea of what the actual perfect in real life genetic code is.
Interesting.
But yeah, so coming up on our hour here, final thoughts for Blade Runner, Jets?
Well, all the reviews seem to be pretty positive so far, so that's a good sign, considering, you know, it seems to be popular to hate everything. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope that I'm going to like it half as much as these reviews are saying.
And they're glowing over the visuals, and that makes me even more excited to see it in IMAX, because that way there's more pixels on the screen to blast my eyeballs.
Sure. I'm excited to see it a little bit. I'm not so enamored with, I guess, the story. I don't know what the story is. I've been avoiding any spoilers or anything like that. I think that visually it looks great. I have a lot of faith in Ryan Gosling as an actor. I think he's kind of understated, because he chooses a lot of movies that are, I guess you could say, challenging to popular opinion, and some of them are outright bad. But I'm also interested. Dave Bautista's in it. I like Dave Bautista. Yes. I think that it's going to be cool to see him, presumably as a replicant, presumably fighting Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford at some point. And Edward James Olmos is reprising his role as Gaff now that I'm looking at IMDb. So, hey, guess who's in it? Should be a good movie. Well, I mean, if it's, you know, it doesn't seem like it's a secret.
And he's bringing his origami with him.
Oh yeah, he's going to fold up into an origami projector and show the first movie so that it pads the runtime of this movie.
Hopefully they'll reference Battlestar Galactica.
He's going to make an origami raccoon and hand it to Batista.
I just realized that Edward James almost was in old Battlestar Galactica. I mostly associate him with his terrible season of Dexter.
Oh yeah.
So, as we enter the end of this series, it's time for, well, the episode, I suppose I should say. It's time for one of our favorite segments here, Defend Your Poor Taste, in which we ask our guests to talk about something that they personally have their own love and affinity for that other people might not properly understand. It can be a guilty pleasure. It can be a movie that you've really been into. It can be Nickelback. We all know people have to like it based on how popular that band continues to be, despite literally everybody saying they hate it. So, David, what's your bag? What are you into?
So there's this movie with Ethan Hawke. It's really good. It's science fiction. It's called Gattaca, which I just learned. I didn't even know this. People hate this movie. I didn't know this. To me, I thought it was it's genius. It's a masterpiece. And I just learned I'm just strucken that you guys hate this film. Well, David doesn't. He hasn't seen it yet.
I don't see it. I don't hate it. I just don't think of the movie. It barely exists in my memory. It is a movie that I remember seeing on, like, Showtime or HBO on one of those weekends when it was free as a kid. And, well, as a kid, like, as, like, you know, a 15-year-old kid, and not really being that into it. But I'm not the biggest Ethan Hawke fan, if I can be serious. The only movie that I've seen of his that I've enjoyed, with the possible exception of The Purge, was Training Day.
Okay, and, so I knew you were going to say Training Day.
Yeah, evidently it was good enough to win him an Oscar, so, you know, works out.
I will see Gattaca by the time you are back on the show.
There you go.
So by 2019.
We'll have you on before 2019.
Yeah, we'll have those flying robots and cars that go upward by 2019, too. So it's going to be a busy couple of years.
Yeah. We're going to get there, though.
All right. So that leads to our weekly picks, where we talk about what we're reading, playing, watching, listening to throughout the week. Dave, would you like to start us off?
My weekly picks is still, and I did a review for it, FIFA 18. I'm a soccer junkie. I've been playing FIFA, and there's not a whole lot more to talk about except it's a ball, you kick it into a net, and you win games. So, moving on from FIFA, the book Spirits of Vengeance came out today, and we have talked off air how much I despise the Ray's Ghost Driver. I will not refer to him as Ghost Rider because he is not. So to get my hands on the Spirit of Vengeance and actually see Johnny Blaze return as Ghost Rider and turn into my favorite guy and just take out these two alien cops, it brought back happy, warm memories. And then you also throw in Hellstrom, who is more of a Wall Street-type looking devil instead of the rebellious one we've seen of late. And then to see Blade make a pretty interesting return. I knew they would have, like, some interesting way to introduce him into the book, and they did, and I was so thankful that it didn't feel forced. It just fit neatly into the story. So I am on board for, I think it's 6 issues of Spirit of Vengeance, so I'm totally on board with the story. I look more forward to seeing Johnny Blaze. I hope everyone goes out and buys this book so we get more Blaze and less Reese.
It's Reyes, by the way. But
down.
Right. I mean, see who the Ghost Driver fan is in this trio.
I do appreciate the term Ghost Driver, though. That is very appropriate for it. David, how about you? What are you into this week?
Zelda Breath of the Wild. I just finished finding all the maps, all the towers to complete the map, and I found all the memories. So, like, I'm getting a little bit closer to the end. I know this is a 100-plus-hour game. But it never stops being fun. As far as comics, next week, The Defenders number 6 comes out, which is written by Brian Michael Bendis and drawn by David Marquez. I think it's a fantastic book. A lot of the reason is because of Marquez's art, which is, I want to own it. Unfortunately, he draws digitally. So you can't just buy like the actual thing he put ink on. You have to buy like a digital representation. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That series is a lot of fun, and he's getting to like the roots of like street level superheroing, which is you don't see that all the time, especially with characters becoming Hydra and godlike every other day of the week. And outside of that, I mean, I'm in Blade Runner mode, man. I can't wait for tomorrow, and it was fun watching it yesterday, and then it was fun talking about it with you guys.
Yeah. As for me, books I recently reviewed and I'm very much still enamored of, The House of Women, which is a book by Sophie Goldstein. Really amazing book, kind of on the visual side, very reminiscent of Persepolis, in that is all black and white, strong open spaces that are filled with very deliberate lines, nothing wasted, nothing too elaborate. She does pull out some tricks in a couple of different sequences, but it's a brilliant, like, if you like the movie The Others or The Woman in Black or any of those Hammer movies that are about haunted house and like some woman lives there by herself or maybe with her children and is slowly realizing that things are not the way they should be, it's pitch perfect sci-fi take on that. Also explores things about colonialism and how to approach natives when you are from a quote-unquote more advanced species. The exploitation of the innocent is a big part of it. Sex, gender, identity, all of that is so neatly wrapped in a not very verbal book. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of exposition. So much is conveyed just by the images, and it's really powerful. Can't recommend it enough. First of a trilogy. Go check it out.
I just got a notification that Sophie Goldstein retweeted your review.
Well, she's amazing. I'm glad she did. Then there's, as far as playing, I recently joined PlayStation Plus, so I'm getting on with the free games that they've got up right now, and so I just recently finished my good playthrough of Infamous Second Son, which is the sequel sister, I guess you could call it like a spiritual sequel to the Infamous series from the PlayStation 3, that was about a guy who gained superpowers and how there is a secret government agency that wants to kill everybody with superpowers. In this one, you take a character with the unfortunate name of Delson Rowe. It is kind of neat. He is, I'm assuming, based on the fact that he's living with a tribe, although he doesn't have a lot of traditionally native features, that he's Native American, so that's kind of neat. It's good to see people of color represented in video games, since most protagonists are, you know, white dudes with gruff voices and dark hair. He does have dark hair, and he does have sort of a gruff voice because he's voiced by Nolan North. But, yeah, just going through, there is not a terribly rich morality system, but there is a good differentiation between playing through as a good guy versus playing as a bad guy. Certain moves are a lot easier when you're a villain. You get advantages with, it's easier to fill up your super attacks. It's easy. You get more access to kill moves. But when you are the good guy, you get the ability to slow down time and all these other things that make certain activities a lot easier. Anyway, it's a bit of fun. It's a relatively quick game. If you're playing the quote-unquote campaign mode or story mode, you can probably finish it in about 10 hours. So that's why I'm now on my evil playthrough. I find, like, if I'm playing any kind of game that has a good and an evil playthrough, I always do the good side first, because playing through the evil side feels really unnatural and awful. But that's just because my folks raised me right. with that being said, I want to thank you guys for getting this far and into our podcast. We'll be, you know, checking this thing out and making it better as the weeks go along. But thanks for joining us on our maiden voyage. You can find me online on Instagram and Facebook at Felix Lancaster, or on adventuresinpoortaste.com, where I and the other gentlemen here are also writers. Dave, where can we find you?
No Socialize. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm No Socialize on Twitter.
And you can find Dave, my co-host, at...
I am mostly on Twitter, and that is under Psychotic, and that is spelled S-Y-C-O-T-I-C.
So check us out there, and come back next week, and we'll see you then. Take care, gang.